Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a drug policy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Drug policy, as in rules and regulations on legal and illegal drugs. There are opposing philosophies on drugs in the United States. So let me just differentiate between drug criminalization, legalization, and commercialization. There are those who support decriminalizing drugs. If you're using drugs and not harming anyone, we shouldn't go to jail. Decriminalize means using drugs should not be a crime. Then there are those who go further and advocate for full drug legalization. Heroin, cocaine, fentanyl, they should all be legal. And then there is commercialization. Commercialization means I should be able to buy cocaine at a bar like I buy a glass of wine. You have your wine, I have my line. That's the motto I've heard from the Drug Policy Alliance. And then there's a gradient on drug commercialization. The radical extreme want to be able to sell fentanyl and cocaine. These are extreme views, not big business. Big business, like big pharma, big tobacco, want to profit from addiction. Marijuana, psychedelics, kratom, hallucinogens. This is a billion-dollar industry that wants to compete with the alcohol industry. They have learned from big tobacco and know all the tricks on how best to increase sales and profits regardless of addiction and health consequences. Frequently, once you legalize, commercialization go hand in hand. So decriminalization, legalization, commercializations, these are different aspects of drug policy. And then there are those who build consensus based on medical, professional, scientists, and researchers with the gold standard of promoting public health. These experts promote smart drug policy. To learn more about smart drug policy, I reached out to Luke Niferatos. Luke Niferatos serves as Executive Vice President of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, SAM, and Foundations for Drug Policy Solutions, FDPS. He's widely recognized as the nation's leading drug policy expert, and Luke has testified in state capitals across America. He's a sought-after guest on major media outlets. If you watch news stories or follow social media with drug issues, you probably saw or heard from Luke. To learn more about Luke Niferatos, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Luke on June 13th, 2025. Luke Niferatos, welcome to High Truths.
Dr. Lev, it's so great to be on, and I've been avidly listening to your show for a very long time. So when you reached out, it was quite an honor. So thrilled to be here with you today.
Yeah, I should have done it sooner. We've known each other and you've been such an expert, and it's like, wait, why didn't I do this already? So very excited to have you on. Learn from you. I'm also a fan in smart drug policies, and that's what you've, you know, spent years doing and advocating for. But let me ask you why. And of all the things, you know, I think I feel like I've known you since you were a little kid. And although you were like a married man, but you could have done anything in your life. You could have pursued any aspects. You're so talented, and yet you chose a difficult field to be in, not a popular field to be in defending smart drug policies. How did that come about? Why?
Great question. Well, you know, my career started actually in healthcare, which is why I so appreciate what you do, because I started off the first 10 years of my career working really at the behest of doctors such as yourself, helping them see more patients and be more efficient, and working at upper level management in corporate headquarters of hospital systems, et cetera. And, coming from that healthcare background, I looked at this issue from a public health perspective. And, living in Colorado, being raised there, I saw what, firsthand what legalization looked like. And I remember when medical marijuana came through and passed and, was sold as something that was going to be for patients. And then, I was in college and my roommate had a medical marijuana card based on something he said he openly lied to get. And I quickly realized what a farce medical marijuana programs could be. And then I watched my state legalize recreational marijuana, become the first state to do that in 2012. And I saw how basically overnight the entire identity of our state changed. And as a single, young man living there, I kind of saw it as a negative thing. I voted against it, but I kind of didn't really think much else about the policy. It was later when I got married and then I had my first daughter that I really thought about the impacts. And I think that's what we're seeing a generation really waking up to now, after about 11 years or so of legalization, which is that, it really impacts the family. There are children all across this country who are harmed by legalization of marijuana policies. And so for me, I just really saw that impact. My wife and I actually saw the impacts of secondhand marijuana smoke on our daughter when she was a baby, and we were taking her on walks in strollers and realizing that that smoke dynamic was there for her. She was inhaling that as a young child and realized that that happens to a lot of people in Colorado and in other states that have legalized it. And so it was around that time, I had just left a company actually that I sold in the digital health space, that I met Kevin Sabet, who I now work with, and he was the founder and CEO of SAM and is currently. And, he came to Colorado and spoke. I was just blown away that there was somebody starting up an organization to take on this fight. Because like you said, it felt like, everyone wants legalization. Everyone's kind of, what's the big deal? But there was this huge fight happening. And I was just thrilled that somebody was putting public health over profit, that somebody was trying to speak the truth about what was really happening on the ground. And so I joined up. And so Kevin and I came on. I joined Kevin, and we had one employee at the time. And now we're pushing 15 employees. And wow, we have two office locations, one in D.C. and one in New York City. And the organization has grown tremendously. So that's been pretty cool to see. And but to answer your question, I'm in it not because I had any personal experience with drug use in any way. I actually grew up in a substance-free household. But for me, being somebody who worked in public health, somebody on the ground at ground zero, truly Colorado, for drug legalization, I knew that, there was nobody really serving the need and we needed more people to work on that cause. And I was thrilled to join it. Been doing it for about 8 years now.
Right. And you do that, you do work on the policy, but you're also, it seems to me like a great debater. Is that something that you enjoyed? Is that something that you study?
Yeah, well, I've always loved a good debate. I'm known as the fighter in my family. So yeah, I lived in a newer community of Aurora, Colorado when I was young, it didn't have a districted high school. So my parents were like, well, which high school do you want to go? You can go to any of the high schools in the public system. And I chose the one that had the best debate team at the time. Right. And so that tells
you
a little bit about
me. How
did
I know that? I saw
that. Yeah. I've always loved debate. And so I really enjoy a good debate. And I think probably one of my favorite moments in my career so far was getting a chance to debate John Morgan, really, I think, the most successful plaintiff attorney maybe in America, certainly the wealthiest firm, Morgan & Morgan, debating him on his turf in Tampa Bay for a maxed out crowd. That was a great debate, and definitely folks should check that out. But it was on whether or not we should legalize marijuana, and I think I did okay.
Yeah, that is amazing. And on top of that, you're gonna become a lawyer, right? You're gonna pursue a law degree. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Yeah, I already probably people are saying, well, how's he doing all this stuff? It's totally, I have to say, it's just totally God, and then just supportive family and wife that make it possible. But I did finish my first year part-time law school at Denver Law Program, and I'm thrilled to have achieved that, pulled that off. It feels great. But I think with this cause, the legal component of this is becoming more and more important because of a few different things. First of all, we've got more Americans that are harmed by this industry than ever before. Millions of Americans are being lied to. These industries are making, these marijuana companies are making therapeutic claims that they should not be. This is leading to harm for a lot of children, youth, young adults, and even adults. And so there needs to be more plaintiff side litigation to secure justice against these companies and keep them in line. I also think that when it comes to what's going on legally in terms of the laws that are being passed, we need lawyers that are going to put public health first, that understand drug policy. You know, this is a very niche field. I mean, Dr. Lev, you probably know as well as I do, you try to count off the number of experts, lawyers in this field or policy experts in this field. It's a very small group of people, and we need to expand that group. And so I think we need more lawyers that are dedicated to this, that are not going to go work for giant corporations for a big paycheck, but are instead going to work for the public interest when it comes to drug policy. And I'm going to be one of those people. I'm certainly not interested in making profit. Sam, we are very much invested in fighting for people harmed by these industries. And so that's what I'm kind of looking at doing with the law. So more to come on that.
That's great. And one of the things that, you know, you wanted to talk about is the gold standard for drug policy. What is the gold standard for drug policy? And that brings us to the conversation about the Hyannis consensus. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. So we're really thrilled. So about 3 years ago, Kevin and I had kind of a final culminating discussion around the need to expand our mandate. We felt like we looked across the field of drug policy, and there's so many organizations doing fantastic work, solving big problems, bringing forth innovative solutions. You know, you look at CADCA in prevention, you look at Hazelden, Betty Ford, you look at, there's a lot of other groups and big associations, treatment providers associations, et cetera, that are doing great work, but they're within their particular fields. And there was nobody that was saying, let's take a holistic look at drug policy. Let's bring everyone together from all the different stakeholders, all the different elements of the field. And let's put forth a comprehensive vision of what needs to happen. And then not just vision, let's put forth specific policy goals and deliverables and achievements that should happen in order to treat this nation's rapidly rising drug and addiction crisis that we all know we're dealing with. And that was, a discussion we had. And we felt like, you know, we went around, we asked hundreds and hundreds of stakeholders across the country, even across the world, you know, do you feel like that need is being met? And they all agreed there was a need for it greater than ever, but they also agreed that nobody was really meeting that need in a comprehensive way. So we decided to start a sister organization to Smart Approaches to Marijuana, which, as most people should know, is the largest organization fighting against the commercialization of marijuana and fighting for public health as it relates to marijuana policy. But now we have a sister organization we founded about 3 years ago called the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions. And its mandate, we launched it in Manhattan with then Biden drug czar, Dr. Gupta, and a number of other public officials, local officials, scientists, researchers. Its mandate was to create a blueprint. So we were going to spend the next 2 years to build a blueprint towards these aims across six pillars. We were going to really look to bring a comprehensive approach to drug policy. So this is now 2 years later. We've launched and released this blueprint. We're very proud of it. I encourage people to go to gooddrugpolicy.org. You can also go to blueprint.gooddrugpolicy.org, and that you can get right to the digital version of the blueprint. But essentially, we consult with hundreds of experts across the world, across the country, people with lived experience, people in recovery, treatment, law enforcement, prevention, everybody in between, everyone you can think of. When you see the names of the people that participated, it will knock your socks off. It's people who are really renowned researchers from all the major institutions, policy, some people confidential from different administrations, politicians, lots and lots of different stakeholder inputs went into this document. And we're very proud of it, Dr. Lev. I mean, really what this represents is basically a knowledge dump of really the best and brightest ideas from the field, well-researched, well-cited. We spent a lot of time meticulously working through this document, and we feel like it's providing a proactive vision for what drug policy should look like. It should start with prevention. It should work all the way through to recovery. We have to have law enforcement. We have to have public health. They have to work together. We can't do things in silos. And so that's really the heart and soul of what we're doing with this blueprint. So here's what kind of makes us different, Dr. Lev.
Well, talk about the blueprint, because when you said you started, you said you did it under the Biden administration. Now we know that we have a different administration.
Yep, that's right.
It seems like there's a lot of pettiness in politics. Like, well, if that's a Biden thing, I don't want it. If it's a Trump thing, I don't want it.
So it's always been bipartisan. Yeah, it's always been bipartisan. So we had Republican officials, Democrat officials there. Where this culminated was actually in Hyannis. So to answer your question, we all gathered in Hyannis, and we had people from both sides of the aisle there.
Where is Hyannis?
Hyannis is the Kennedy compound there in Massachusetts. And it's a really special place for those who haven't visited it or haven't seen it. Some really amazing American history has happened there at that Hyannis Kennedy compound. There have been major heads of state from all around the world who have met there. So it was a very special and really sacred experience, quite frankly. And there we kind of hammered out the final details of this blueprint. And what was interesting about was what kind of initiated it. So what initiated it was we gathered in Hyannis around, I think it was September of last year. So it was during the election. And we had had representatives from both presidential campaigns at different times, totally unbeknownst to each other, had asked us, you know, what would you recommend for our transition team? What would you recommend for our policy priorities? And it was perfect because we're a nonpartisan organization. We're here. We're not picking horses. We're here to advise whoever is going to be in power in this country. So we thought, why don't we just do this now? We can prepare this document, make it actionable for, you know, both campaigns, both administration, whoever is going to win, it would be available to those administrations. And so that's the approach we took to it. And so we met in Hyannis, we hammered it out. It was a great invigorating discussion. We agreed to these principles. That's what's in the blueprint. And so now what we've been working to do is actually get this done. Because Dr. Love, that's what I was going to say is the difference between us and all a lot of the other think tank type organizations you see in DC is they're often thinking and writing about things, but they're not doing. But we are a think and a do organization. And I know you've seen that over the years with us. But so we thought, we wrote, and now we're going to go forth and do. And we want to get these policy recommendations passed at the federal level as well as at the state level. So that's what we're working on now is the next phase
examples.
Of our mandate.
What is it? So the think, so you have the blueprint, and it includes things that that are not new, right? We've always talked about prevention and treatment. And crime and other things like that. That's always been, you know, that's always been part of the drug policy. What are some of the that's very generic, but I'm sure you have some specifics.
Yes, of course. So yes, and I think it's great that you brought up that they're not new because I think there's a lot of kind of cynicism in the drug policy environment. People just say, well, you know, people, you know, there's a lot of people that are just going to always use. There's nothing we can do about this crisis. So we should just legalize all these drugs because, you know, we basically have failed. And I think there's a lot of people that approach it that way. And it just could not be further from the truth. There are so many programs that have been around for decades and are working, are not just working. They are incredibly cost effective. And they're actually having tremendous results in the communities where these programs are running. A great example is HOPE Hawaii. This is a program that's going on in Hawaii right now. Judge Steve Alm, a longtime friend of ours, and now the prosecutor there in Honolulu, he has really pushed this as an approach to this drug crisis. It's combined both law enforcement and public health. Essentially, you know, boil it down to the basics, it provides carrots and sticks. It provides somebody who is coming in with a drug problem that's leading to other criminal issues. It gives them a chance to get sober, stay sober, and then not take on a criminal record. And that program is having immense success. It's and I think, you know, as policymakers, they're often not just looking for.
That sounds like drug courts.
Yeah, it's very similar to drug courts. And drug courts are another program that's been in existence for a number of decades. And we also support that program as well. So both those programs are mentioned within this blueprint. And what we're trying to do is say, look, we're not here, you know, nothing in this blueprint is, you know, we didn't kind of concoct some crazy new cockamamie idea of, you know, here's the brand new solution. These solutions are already out there. States are implementing them very well and effectively. They're saving taxpayer dollars. And they're setting people free from addiction, which is obviously the most important thing. We need to take these programs to scale. They're working at the state level. They're working at the city level. Now we need to take these to Washington and get funding for these to expand them nationwide. And it makes a lot of sense, not just from the standpoint of setting people free from addiction, getting them into recovery, but it makes a lot of sense from a policy perspective in terms of saving taxpayer dollars. Because I think we all know what's going on right now is not working. You know, we have different administration priorities for every 4 years. There are some who say it should all be a healthcare issue. And so we spend years focusing only on healthcare. Then there are some who say it's only a criminal justice issue. We spend years only focusing on, you know, supply reduction, which is an important piece of this, just like demand reduction is. But we can't just do one or the other. We have to have all the legs of the stool. And that's really what we're trying to push for.
Right. So prevention, primary prevention, I think that's key because, as they say, we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We're not going to treat our way out of this problem, but we could prevent our way out of the problem.
Yeah, we know prevention programs are among the, you know, it's so interesting. This administration is really highlighting the importance of cost effectiveness, not wasting taxpayer dollars, using the programs that are most effective and really, focusing on those. You want to talk about a great thing to invest taxpayer dollars in? It's prevention, primary prevention. Dr. Lev, you took the words right out of my mouth. That needs more investment than ever, because we know that if we can prevent drug use before it starts, particularly before the age of 21, we know that 95 plus percent of people, if they don't 21? Use by 21, if we get them before 21, if we get them to 21 without trying drug drugs, they're unlikely to ever do so. Prevention is the most important thing. It has to be the bedrock, the foundation of any approach to drug policy and treating
I agree. This addiction but crisis. Not with the 21. 21 is the lawyer age. Okay. That's the legislative age. The doctor age.
Too. Yeah.
The doctor age is 25.
Yeah, 25. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm fine with that as well. But it really is. You look at so many of the comorbidities that you look at the top 10, and you know this, Dr. Lev, because you're in healthcare and treating these patients every day. Top 10 morbidities for Americans in this country, almost all of them are related to our legal or illegal drug use. I mean, you look at tobacco, it's related to 3 to 5 of those top 10 diagnoses. You look at alcohol, it's related to those. A lot of this is driving and exacerbating what's happening with obesity. So, you look at this MAHA program. And I think part and parcel of making America healthy again is absolutely we need to get these diets out of food. We need to have these different approaches. We need to also keep in mind that there, in addition to Monsanto, there are Monsanto cannabis and drug brands that are out there that are doing this to our kids as well, pitching them these products as if they're natural when they're not at all natural. They're coated in pesticides and all kinds of artificial things. And I think we have to also include that in this MAHA discussion as well.
Yes, I love the MAHA principle and it very much has a direct correlation to drugs, right? We could put all our efforts on people who are really sick and addicted to drugs. I mean, that's important, but why don't we go upstream and prevent it in the first place? And the same thing, we could do all the Ozempics and gastric bypasses for obesity, or go uphill, upstream and prevent obesity and have a better diet in the first place and less processed food. So I see like a direct correlation. I don't know if RFK Jr. sees it that way, but I definitely see that correlation.
I think he does. And, our co-founder is Patrick Kennedy, former congressman from Rhode Island, and cousins he is with RFK. So we know that they have a great relationship. And that's something that I think we're going to continue to discuss with them as well, as how we can incorporate sound and smart drug policies into this conversation as well. Because I think a lot of people would be stunned. I mean, even with this psychedelics discussion, there's a lot of interest in psychedelics right now. And I think, Elon Musk has provided a little bit of a cautionary tale, if you will, because it's very public that he'd been overusing ketamine, for example. That's a drug that a lot of people have been saying is, maybe that's the easy button solution to depression. And I think the jury's still out. Yes, the FDA's, approved some very limited applications of it. But what we're seeing is that the fever around psychedelics is vastly exceeding the reality. And the research is providing a lot of areas of caution around psychosis, mental health issues, the persistent hallucinogenic disorder that now is popping up with the use of psychedelics, which, if you haven't heard of that, HPPD, it's a really kind of frightening thing that now is starting to rise for folks that are using these drugs. And so I think even with this psychedelics discussion, we're seeing some cautionary tales. Also, I think people would be surprised to see the major conglomerates that are funding these pushes. And I think, coming back to the original, the start of the discussion, Dr. Lev, around justice for the people over corporate interests, these marijuana companies, there's just now huge addiction conglomerates. Now there's pharmaceutical companies involved. Now there are major Silicon Valley investors that are involved that are pushing these drugs as solutions to crises. And to your point, we have to get upstream from that. We need to be preventing drug use before it starts. That's going to help us avoid so many of these problems. And I'm a little bit worried that, we're letting the fever pitch get too high. So I think that's something that we need to speak more truth into.
As a physician, I can understand how it's happened, but I think the voice of medicine has really lost the clout that it should have. So people just hear about, whatever. They see a commercial on TV like, hey, take this for your psoriasis. And it's like, okay, I want some of that. And it's like, you know, just because something has some therapeutic effect, THC may have some therapeutic effects. The psychedelics may have some therapeutic effects, but there is an FDA and medicinal process to do that. Just because you hear something's good, it doesn't mean, okay, let's buy it on Amazon, right? Oxycodone, you know, has good therapeutics, you know, under a, you know, real, not fake, a real medicinal standard of care. But that doesn't mean you should just be able to buy that and treat yourself and, you know, die from a opioid overdose because you had some pain.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, I understand where people are coming from in terms of, look, there's been a number of missteps by the FDA that I think have breached the public trust. And we can all think of the various examples of that happening. And obviously not the least of which is the opioid dilemma that they approved some of these opioids. They probably shouldn't have done it in the way that they did. So I don't think anyone's saying the FDA is perfect. However, the alternative, I think we're seeing canaries in the coal mine when we see things happening, like, for example, with Elon Musk. We saw Matthew Perry die, you know, from a ketamine-related death. We see a number of other deaths now related to these other substances that are out there. You know, the alternative, if we say, okay, we're not going to listen to the scientists or the doctors when it comes to medicine, the alternative we've seen is a state like Colorado voting to legalize medical marijuana, now voting to legalize medical psychedelics. State like Oregon doing the same thing. So what we're saying is, okay, we're not going to trust science and medicine. We're going to just instead trust the people who have enough money to fund ballot measures to say, let's legalize these drugs and call them medicine. Well, right. I'm concerned about that because you have entrepreneurs who they just want to make money and they're the ones telling us what medicine is for the first time in this country's history.
And you're not, and you don't have the equal access, right? So Clear Scientific is trying, you know, he's working years to develop an antidote for methamphetamine, but they're going through, you know, millions of dollars, many years, FDA trials. You don't see them like getting a lobby and say, hey, this is good. Let's just do this. So you could buy it on Amazon and treat your methamphetamine problem. You know,
that's right. And the reason why that's worth it is so people don't die. The reason why that's worth it is so we don't shotgun a drug out onto the public and it all of a sudden does things we didn't know were going to happen. That's why we do that process. Yeah. And so I am worried. And I think, you know, we're going to have a lot more. I think people have probably heard of Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, who is in jail now for her test that wasn't working, little blood test that was pricking. She was lying to the American public.
How many really smart people, like Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, gave her money because he really believed in her probably persona rather than her science.
And that's the path forward for medicine. If we continue to vote for medicine at the ballot, that is the path forward. It'll be entrepreneurs and big corporations and conglomerates who are the ones who decide what medicine is that way. I think having some science involved in the FDA process is going to save us a lot of heartburn.
Yeah, I hope so. It may not be perfect, but that is worldwide gold standard for medicines and therapy. And it should be. You mentioned Elon Musk, and I just want to say that, you know, anybody who watch the Twitter wars or the behavior in the Oval Office. I just saw somebody who has an addiction, who is manic and acting irrationally because of drugs. I think we witnessed the effect of drugs on TV and on Twitter. And I'm a fan of Elon Musk, and I just wish him medically well because I'm worried about him.
Definitely agree with you on that. Definitely agree with you on that. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, you look at talking about corporate claims, and I mentioned a little bit earlier about therapeutic claims. You know, there are companies now, in the marijuana space, there's one called iHeartJane. It's like the Amazon of cannabis is what they're pitching themselves as. And 20% of all the marijuana bought and sold in the country is bought and sold on that platform. And if you go to their website and look at the products they're selling, they have products that say, you know, Raspberry Kush, for example, it's a vaporized product. Raspberry Kush, ideal for treating your bipolar disorder, ideal for treating schizophrenia. The companies are making
Why is that legal?
Outrageous claims.
Why can you make health claims like that?
You can't. You can't do that. And so you think about the vulnerable populations that suffer when we allow things like this to happen. And so I think we need to see FDA action on this kind of behavior. But I think it's also kind of spurring a backlash against marijuana, Dr. Lev. I don't know if you're seeing that. You're in San Diego, and I know seeing patients every day. But I think we're seeing some public sentiment push back against this idea that marijuana is harmless and we should have legalization everywhere.
Yeah, it takes a critical mass. You know, for people to speak up. I've witnessed that with the opioid prescription problem, right? Where enough parents were angry about their children dying from opioid prescription. And they were ahead of the curve before the medical community came up. And so I don't, it's just a matter of time. I don't know if we're there with marijuana. I know that there's a growing, I just see them and I meet with them, the growing body of parents who've been harmed, who are speaking out at great risk to themselves to speak out. It's not easy for them, but it's just a matter of time before they get to be a critical mass in the public.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. So it's SAM, again, that's at learnaboutsam.org. We have a parent action network that we started about a year ago, and that is going gangbusters. Essentially, what we're doing is we have wonderful woman, Chrissy, and her team, Bronwyn and others, who are basically, they are there to be a resource to parents who have been hurt by marijuana. Their children have been hurt. They themselves have been hurt. Other family members have been hurt. And we have unprecedented outreach of people all across the country who are saying, my kid got addicted. My kid died by suicide after, you know, dabbing marijuana, all kinds of stories. And what we're doing is we're training these parents to tell their stories out in the public sphere to educate the public, because, you know, there's so many myths out there that, you know, marijuana is harmless. It doesn't hurt anybody. It never killed anybody. And so you have so many parents that are wanting to push back on that narrative. So we've seen that really grow. The other thing interesting, and I know you had not that long ago, you had Sarah Carter, our incoming drug czar, on your podcast, which was a great episode and people should listen to that one. But, you know, Sarah Carter was rightly talking about the explosion of Chinese foreign cartels that are now getting in bed with these marijuana companies. And yeah, I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, places like Oklahoma is seeing, I think they estimate more than 70% of their state legal medical marijuana companies have some sort of foreign Chinese CCP cartel involvement that's going on. And it's just crazy to think about. But you actually have the Drug Enforcement Administration that is testifying about this before Congress, how this growing foreign cartel threat within state legal marijuana companies is becoming a real problem. And they're actually laundering fentanyl dollars there. So I think communities like Oklahoma and others are seeing this. So you saw Oklahoma overwhelmingly reject legalization of recreational a couple of years ago. We've seen now 7 out of 10 states have voted no on legalizing recreational marijuana over the last 4 years. So I think we're definitely starting to see a swing in the other direction towards sanity. I think people are seeing those impacts, the crime, the harm to communities. You know, there's so many parents that are grieving lost loved ones. And I think, you know, we're starting to see some turn there, and our organization's there to serve and fill the gap.
Yeah. I did an episode with Sebastian Rotella, and he wrote an article in ProPublica about it, but he gave amazing accounts about what's really going on in Oklahoma and how it's like, you know, it's like a Godfather episode. But instead of an Italian gang, it's the Chinese gangs, and how they're really they've dominated. Chances are, if you're smoking pot, there's a Chinese footprint in there,
and not just a Chinese footprint, but also a human trafficking footprint.
Yes,
and I think that's what people don't. It's part and parcel of the whole business. And I think people think, well, we're going to regulate these drugs, or whatever, but drug use, you know, is an activity that, you know, always has included other crime with it. You know, go figure, you bring drug dealers into your neighborhood, you can call them anything you want. It's not going to make your neighborhood safer. It's going to make your neighborhood a lot less safe. And there's going to be a lot more problems that come along with it. And so what we've seen is, yes, bring a pot shop into your community, you're bringing cartel activity there. Also seeing the issue of human trafficking. They did a big expose, NBC News did last year, looking into California's industry and finding that the vast majority of these marijuana products, most of them touched somebody that was human trafficked into the country to work as cheap or free labor for these illegal grows. So very, very concerning to see the conglomeration of a lot of different illegal things happening. And it all is made possible when a state votes and gives legal cover to these illegal activities. So I think that's something that's key to understand.
What is the position of the blueprint on marijuana? Should it be legalized? Should it, you know, limit certain type of products? Or was there a consensus on that?
Yes. So no, we don't believe marijuana should be legalized. And so what we put forth in the document was a primary prevention focus on marijuana. So needs to be prevented. We have a whole kind of one page outline of the marijuana issue, so that the problems, what our biggest concerns are public health wise, and basically how the public needs to be educated about especially today's high potency marijuana. And I know, Dr. Love, you know all about this, but for those of you listening who don't know, marijuana is much more potent than it's ever been. 99% now today products are 99% potent THC versus just 3% a few decades ago. So totally different products. Now you can vape them. Now you can eat them, all kinds of different ways to use. And that has brought a lot more deleterious effects to the public. And so the we've done polls in the past. Even in states like Colorado, we did a poll where, you know, they've had marijuana legal there for about 11 years. You would think everybody in Colorado knows what the industry is about and what products they're selling. But 70% of Coloradans didn't even know that the products that were being sold were highly potent. They didn't even know the forms of products that were being sold at these marijuana shops. They had no idea. And when we told them, hey, did you know that it's a 99%? You know, shatter that is being sold. They didn't like that. They were opposed to that idea. So I think, you know, there's this misnomer out there that, well, everyone's aware of what's going on. The average person really doesn't know. There needs to be a lot more education. So we think definitely it starts there.
Yeah, I don't think the average person knows. The average user probably doesn't know. The health harms are not known. I'm just wondering, did the consensus blueprint is just completely opposition, or was there any like list of regulations? I can't see the states like Colorado or California or other states that have legalized going backwards.
Yes, good question. So yeah, it's not just about whether something's legal or not. I mean, it's a very comprehensive look with a lot of different approaches. So yes, there's a place in the blueprint for everybody. If you're somebody that supports legalization, there's a load of things there that will be very useful for you. If you're a policymaker in Washington state, this blueprint will definitely equip you to deal with marijuana in your state. And no, it's not, you know, hey, roll it back, right? It's, you know, cap the potency of marijuana, educate the public on its harms to your mental health, for example. In fact, we had a lawmaker that gave a lot of input.
Candy ban? Do you have a candy ban?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if that's directly stated in there, but yeah, the candy ban is something we are definitely pushing for. We need that candy ban. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a bill brought forward by Senator Feinstein when she was in office, as well as Senator Grassley in Congress. And that was something they brought forward every session. We need new members to take up the candy ban bill, expanding criminal penalties for people who turn any substance, including marijuana, into candy form, increasing the penalties for that. That's something we absolutely need to see.
Yeah, we tried that in California. It didn't go. You would think that would be such a white hat issue. We have all the data and all the babies are being poisoned. And why do you need candy? You could use your pot. Why do you have to make it into candy form?
Well, I'll tell you, that's why I'm doing law school, because you know what they do? They hire great, smart lawyers who say, oh, that language doesn't say that, you know, you don't have to have candy, or, you know, they can't be candy. And they figure out a way to get right around it. And we need a lot more lawyers who are going to be there to say, I don't think so. And also include that, make sure that language is included as well.
Yep. That's very important, Luke. Thank you. Anything else in the blueprint? I'm trying to think of the other controversial stuff. The legalization is definitely controversial. What about harm reduction? That could be controversial. I think it's controversial because we don't have a definition, and people define harm reduction as syringe exchange and naloxone, and some of them do criminal justice, you know, a social justice. And there's a huge spectrum of what harm reduction can mean.
Yes. So harm reduction was something we definitely dealt with in the blueprint. And so here's our picture. And I think it's best encapsulated by a quote that our co-founder, Patrick Kennedy, the former congressman, said, which I completely agree with. He said, when it comes to harm reduction, sure, let's meet people where they're at, but we must never leave them there. We cannot leave people where they're at. And so that encapsulates the vision of the foundation and what we're trying to do when it comes to drug policy is, you know, there's a lot of effort out there to set the goalposts for drug policy as keep people with a pulse, basically preserve the pulse, keep them alive. Yes. And that's it. That's just full stop. That's the end of the story. And in my view, you know, that is a very basic component. People need to be alive. So very important. Let's keep people alive. But that cannot be the KPI, if you will. That can't be the key performance indicator for the field of drug policy and what we're doing as a country. Right. It needs to be on how effectively are we getting people into recovery? How effectively are we getting people into sobriety? How are we empowering people to live fully empowered lives to achieve their wildest dreams and their true potential, which every human being is innately given by God to have. And I think as a society, it is incumbent upon us to uplift people and empower them toward that end. That needs to be the metric that we're looking at. And so if that is your vision, and that's the vision of the foundation, then you don't just say, well, we're only going to invest in harm reduction, and we're only going to do naloxone and fentanyl test strips and, you know, other more extreme measures like injection sites, et cetera, and that's what we're going to do. You can't do that. It's got to be harm reduction, and this is what we espouse within the blueprint, is it is a intervention. It is something that is certainly a part of the continuum, but it is a Band-Aid, right? We're stopping the bleeding, but then we're getting you into those wraparound services. We're getting you into recovery programs, into treatment programs, et cetera. We're, you know, for example, something else we espouse in the blueprint is national treatment on-demand system, right? Treatment should be available. It should be easy. It should be cheap. It should be accessible. We have to have that because we know when you're in addiction and you make the decision that you want to get out of addiction, you've got a very short period of time to catch that person before they fall back into addiction. It's got to be quick. So that's got to be the focus. That's the standard we have to hold our policymakers to. If we say, just let's, you know, make sure everyone's got an ocean of naloxone, which we should have. But if we stop there, most people who receive naloxone, they need it again.
Right. I don't consider naloxone like a harm reduction, treatment, prevention. So if you look at cohorts of population, right? On one hand, you have kids who've never used drugs. And on the other hand, you have my patients in the emergency department that are deep into the throes of addiction, may not even want to start. They're living on the street. They're the hardest population to treat. And by the way, I saw this the same when it came to the opioid prescription epidemic, right? People who are opioid naive, they've never had pain medicines. And the ones who are severely addicted, not just to one oxycodone, but a whole bucket full of medications. And I'm like, oh my God, I just need to keep you alive somehow. That's like the harm reduction cohort. But what I'm seeing now with harm reduction, because of a lack of definition, is people going to school and like, oh, we're going to do harm reduction at school. It's like, that's not the population for you. At schools and grade schools and middle schools, the message is prevention. What muddies the waters, I think, is naloxone. Naloxone is a life-saving medication that, with the fentanyl problem that we have, needs to be ubiquitous in every conversation.
Yes, it does.
That's just life-saving. It's not harm reduction. It saves lives. It's not reducing harm. It just saves you from death. And that just needs to be everywhere. But I see people get mixed up when there's lack of definition and lack of understanding of the cohorts of population. And I'm sure that's clarified in your document.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that particularly when you look at something like injection sites, it's something that, you know, is, first of all, it's an extreme measure to take. But second of all, it's something that if it were something to be used, it would be used with a very small population in this country. Very, very small.
All our money is going into this.
And not just money, so much volume, so much discussion around pushing for these proposals. And unfortunately, the folks that are pushing for them are folks like the Drug Policy Alliance, who their vision statement is to legalize all drugs. They want drugs to be freely available for the broader public. This is their top priority. So it's within the context of an organization that they have ulterior motives. And so I do think that it gets us tripped up when what we should be talking about are the 80-20 policy policies we can be implementing that are tremendously effective. Prevention's the first one, extremely cost-effective. The estimation is that it saves the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars, their investment in prevention programs. So that needs to continue, and entities like CADCA need to continue to be funded. But I also think, you know, it goes obviously beyond prevention into these other treatment programs, these other law enforcement, public health partnership programs like drug courts that we talked about. These are very cost-effective programs. And so they need a lot more volume. There are a lot of people who don't even know what a drug court is. And when they hear the name drug court, they think, oh, it, you know, sounds draconian. They don't realize what a great, justice-oriented program that it is. And so I think, you know, there needs to be more education around that. There needs to be more advocacy to expand that. And that's something that we need to spend a lot more time on as a field in drug policy, I think.
Right. You know, the thing about, you know, syringe exchange or consumption sites, that's, again, for that very, very, very extreme population, that's definitely leaving people where they're at instead of, and it's not bringing them to where you are, right? They're saying, come to my facility. But justifying that investment, while there are so many people who want to get sober and there's no place for them to go. Nothing. You know, they have no resources, and yet investing I think that's where investment should be, as far as people who have a substance use disorder, who want to get well and have no place to go.
That's right. Treatment on demand. That's one of the number one things we're talking about and trying to see happen, is we need a strong investment in making treatment available to folks and then getting them into recovery. And the other piece of recovery that's so important is just the idea that we have recovery ready workplaces, right? Recovery ready culture in our cities and in places where people live. And that's where, you know, and people want to try to disentangle these things, but we get the society and the culture that we create. When we legalize classes of drugs, marijuana, psychedelics, these companies then begin to influence the culture. They're present on your street, on your city block. They're advertising on your television or your billboard. They're on the radio. You're seeing their products on the ground after people have used them. This then it embeds into your culture, makes the culture much less recovery friendly. And in fact, that was one of the biggest reasons why Congressman Kennedy got involved in this issue, was the idea that it was going to be horrible for people like him who were in recovery to have marijuana stores all over the place. And we have definitely seen that. And so I think, you know, we have to focus on, I talk about getting people into recovery, helping them sustain their recovery, making sure that our society is there to support them in their recovery. There's a lot of things that looks like, but I do think, you know, the workplace is the place where that has to be. We need to make sure people are not stigmatized because of prior use and addiction. They can start a new life, and also make sure that, you know, it's not easy as just looking at their phone screen for 2 seconds and making 2 taps in order to get fentanyl or marijuana or anything else, which unfortunately, with what we're seeing with social media right now, that's absolutely the case.
Yes. That is important. I do think we've come a long way in that stigma and in supporting recovery. Of course, nothing's perfect, but I think we have come a long way.
I agree, and I think there's a lot more that can be done. But definitely, we're in the right. It's the right moment. And actually, that's something that's really exciting, because I think what we're seeing as an organization now, we've got two organizations. It's SAM and it's FDPS, and what we're seeing now is unprecedented growth to tackle this critical moment. We are now actually expanding our presence in Washington, D.C. We just, thanks to some donors, were able to purchase an office building adjacent to the Supreme Court building. We brought on some new staff. So we're very excited about expanding what we're doing at the national level, and really looking to partner with more organizations that are working in this field also, because that was our vision, right? With FDPS, was to not, you know, we didn't think we had all the ideas. From what's working out there, get together with hundreds of people who are doing the real work and help amplify what they're doing and bring them in front of decision makers. That's really key. And I think, you know, Dr. Lev, you were a fantastic CMO at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And maybe, you know, hopefully I'm pulling for you. Would love to see you back in some sort of position like that again. I think we need people like you there. Who then we can work together to, I think, achieve some of these goals and bring more partners and new voices to the table in D.C. I think that's going to be key.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. Thank you, Luke. We'll see what happens. I don't know. What are your insights on the Trump administration's views on marijuana? I think the president was pro Amendment 3 in Florida, and his experts and staff around him are split in that debate. So I don't know which way things are turning, or can you tell?
Good question. Yeah, it's been interesting to try to read the tea leaves. I mean, I think the big picture is very optimistic for anybody who doesn't want to see drugs legalized in society. President Trump has made it really clear he's not a pro-drug guy. He's not wanting his own family to be involved with substances. He doesn't want to see them grow in society. He doesn't. Actually, it was interesting. Matt Gaetz said recently, he said, President Trump doesn't like anything that dulls your senses, and he doesn't want to see that happening in our society here in America. So I thought that was a very interesting quote from Gaetz. And I think we're seeing some signals that, whatever happened during the campaign trail, that was campaign banter. And I think we're back to an anti-drug stance for the administration, but we'll see, how that proceeds. I do think big picture, that's related to marijuana. Big picture on drug policy, what we're obviously seeing is a heightened sensitivity to the border. to immigration and dealing with the fentanyl and other drug issues that are as they relate to our southern borders, and also a little bit in Canada too. There's been some discussion of the northern border as well. And so I think there's a lot of important work that needs to be done there as far as stopping the flow of fentanyl, stopping the flow of these analogs, dealing with the China problem, especially as it relates to fentanyl, in addition to what they're doing with marijuana as well. So those things I think are very good. That's a good area of focus. They're also looking at other elements of supply reduction, which again, that is a key part of the stool, but it is just one leg of the stool. And so I think what we're going to be looking to do is to partner with the administration to put forth best practices there, but also look at how we can build up really good programs around that. They're going to be recovery oriented as well, which RFK is really interested, obviously, in recovery and expanding what we do in recovery. So I do think there will be some opportunities in both those areas throughout this administration.
That's great. And is there a connection? We talk about drug pop, fentanyl and the border and marijuana. Is there a connection there?
Oh, absolutely.
Of course I know the answer to that.
No, of course there's a big connection. But I think one that people don't really realize, and that is that what the DEA was testifying before Congress a few months ago is this, that the cartels that are primarily dealing in fentanyl, they are using state legal marijuana to launder their fentanyl profits into the American financial system. So it's their way of washing the fentanyl dollars and getting it, the money, to be legitimate in the U.S. banks. And that's something that's happening out of Oklahoma. It's actually happening in Maine. Believe it or not, in Maine, their primary marijuana regulator for their program in Maine actually said they have no ability, because of the way the statutes are written, they have no ability to reject applicants that they know are backed by criminal Chinese syndicates. I don't know how that's possible, but they're actually licensing them and they know that they're doing it. And they admitted it to the press.
Sounds like they need to change the law.
Yeah, they definitely need to change the law. So no, that connection is a very strong one. It's very well established in the data and some of the testimony that's been coming out. And so I think that's a great area to focus on as well, is, what can we do to partner? China's a very anti-drug country. They don't want any of these drugs going around in their country. It's all illegal. We need to make sure that they're respecting our desire to hopefully cut back on drug use in our country, knowing we're one of the top drug consumers in the world. And we need to work with them and do whatever needs to happen in order to help stem that flow.
Yeah. So you pointed out the supply side connection of fentanyl, marijuana. I think the demand side is also there. If we look at the number one drug anybody used ever in their life before an overdose, it was marijuana. If you look at the number of days use of any illicit drug at a young age, it's marijuana. So we see that, and we know biologically also, whether you want to call it a gateway drug or not, that it primes your dopamine part of your brain to want more and more. So there is that demand side connection as well. I think that if we surveyed every person who ever overdosed and asked them what's the drug they first ever used, the overwhelming majority will be marijuana.
Yeah, we know from a lot of the research published over the last 20 years in the Journal of the American Medical Association that is true, that vast majority of the people who have started using these quote-unquote harder drugs, it began with marijuana. It's absolutely something that primes your receptors for using other harder drugs. Very few people are going to just start their drug use journey with meth or something of that nature. So I think understanding also that very few people only use one drug for their whole life. That's something that I think is lost in this discussion. Even in the this is right that we do this in the campaign to focus on fentanyl and deal with its just horrific effects on society. It's not that the folks that are dying of fentanyl overdoses, that's the only substance in their systems. It's not.
It's 80-90% have a poly drug use when they die. You don't die of one drug.
That's right. And so it's important we focus on a deadly drug like fentanyl, but we also have to be cognizant of the fact that this is a comprehensive issue we need to look at. And we need to look at all the drugs that are available, their availability, and what's happening there. And I think that, that's something that's lost on a lot of people, I think, in society, and we need to educate folks on that. And really, that's why we have to hold ourselves to higher ideals, right? Ideal to being drug-free. ideals of being of sobriety, right? Because that is the ultimate way to be able to achieve your potential as a person and for our economy and our country to proceed through this century in a strong and successful fashion.
That's great. Luke, this is such a great conversation. Finally, if you had a, you know, an elevator talk with the president or RFK, what would that conversation be? What would you be your quick little pitch?
My pitch, it's a good question. I would say let's put prevention first and don't legalize drugs. It's been nothing but bad for the places that have tried it.
Right. Very nice. Very good. Great. Anything else you want our listeners to know?
The last thing I'll say is, yeah, please check us out. So I'm on Twitter at Luke Niforatos, at Luke, N-I-F-O-R-A-T-O-S. So check me out on Twitter. Learn about SAM.org is our website. That's also our Twitter handle for SAM. And then finally, Good Drug Policy. That is our Twitter handle for the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions. And it's our website as well, gooddrugpolicy.org. Check us out. And we'd love to engage with you or partner with you in any way. And Dr. Lev, thank you as always. You are one of the key spokespeople in this field and really one of the people making a difference. It's very rare you find somebody who's treating the problem at the ground level, a physician who's willing to give her time for that, as well as speaking into the policy discourse and making such a positive impact. So thank you very much for what you're doing.
That's great. Nick Niforatos, thank you so much. And lots of health and success to you. And I'll put in the show notes those references that you had.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org and ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.